Hey, what's going on, Outlander fans? Welcome to the 12th episode of Bannix Bonnets and Kilts. I'm your host, Jenny Coco Cure. In this week's episode, we're going to be recapping season 3, episode 11 of Outlander, entitled Uncharted. And in this episode, we're going to be dealing with Claire as she is marooned on an uncharted island, essentially. This episode was directed by Charlotte Brandstrom and written by Karen Campbell and Shannon Goss. So we had two writers on this week's episode. So that is interesting. Now, I have watched this episode a couple of times, and I must say I really enjoyed it. I don't know if it had anything to do with the two writers or the fact that everybody was women. Not that I am biased towards women or against men or the other way around. I just happen to think that, I don't know, sometimes when you have an all-female team behind the scenes, it tends to have a different feel and a different vibe. I really enjoyed this episode. I really did. It's probably one of my favorites of the season. It really is. So anyway, let's go ahead and get started with the recap. I'm going to try to keep this one kind of short this week. I know I keep saying that, but this time I mean it. I'm going to keep this short because I got things to do today, to be honest with you. All right, let's see. We start off the episode with the title card, which is essentially just this turtle, like swimming beneath the water in the ocean. Very clear, crystal blue water. And this turtle or tortoise is swimming through, and it looks very pretty. Very under the sea type, whatever. So anyway, we start the episode with Claire floating on the makeshift raft that Mrs. Johansson made for her right as she was jumping off the porpoise into the water. As we will recall from last week's episode, Claire jumped off the porpoise to escape, you know, the Captain Leonard, who, you know, wanted her to stay on board until they reached Jamaica. But Claire was like, nah, I got to go because I got to warn Jamie that y'all finna try to arrest my husband. You're not going to do that. And I'm just going to sit here and allow it to happen. So Mrs. Johansson assisted Claire in escaping. Like I said, she had the little makeshift raft with two barrels tied together and gave her some money and everything and said, go ahead and save your husband, girl. I know what that's like. So Claire jumped off the porpoise, and when we start this episode, it is daytime now, because when she jumped off the porpoise, it was night, and now it's day. She looks like she's been in that water for a minute. She looks all parched and dry. She's kind of sleeping, or maybe just disoriented, weak, whatever the case is. She does not appear to be conscious. So she's holding on to these barrels as she's floating through the water, and she comes across a wave. The wave tilts her over. She, you know, comes up gasping, and she ends up swimming to the shore. When she gets there, fortunately, her bundle with her things in it is there oh so conveniently waiting for her. That's nice. So she gets up and starts laying her stuff out to dry in the sun. She's like, where in the heck am I? You know, narrator Claire is in full effect, pretty much explaining what's going on. She realizes that she is not at Grand Turk, which is where she was supposed to be going, because the place where she ended up was way too big, and she had been floating for way too long. So she knew it wasn't Grand Turk. She had no idea where she was and how she was going to find Jamie. So she sat there giving her clothes a little time to dry, because that's what was in her bundle, her dress, her clothes, all the pieces to it. So she laid them out to dry, and she just put them back on once they were dry and started to trudge through the jungle. She said that she remembered the rule of threes, which is it took 3 minutes for a person to run out of air. It took 3 days for a person to live without water, and 3 weeks for a person to live without food. So she had plenty of air, and well, she wasn't really in danger of starving yet, But the water thing was a problem, so she knew she was going to have to find water really quickly. She saw this plant with some leaves, giant leaves on it, found a little bit of collected rainwater on that and sipped that right up, but it was not going to do. She was going to have to find more before long. But she was just trudging through the jungle. At one point, she decided to sit down using her skirt as like a shed to shield her from the sun. Now, as we will remember, Claire is kind of a survivalist from her Uncle Lamb, you know, because they lived kind of rough, you know, or they did a lot of camping or outdoorsy kind of stuff because, you know, he was, what was Uncle Lamb? He was like a archaeologist, I think. So, you know, they would go on digs and stuff. And in doing so, Claire was with him and would live off the land and, you know, kind of live out in the open like he did. So this was her knack. This was her territory. You know, she was good with this. She was survivalist Claire, you know. So anyway, after she took a little rest under her skirt, she went out and started walking again until she found some flank rocks. I think that's what you call them. Some rocks that, you know, of course she would be able to make use of later. By the time the sun started to come down, she took the rocks out, had gathered some sticks. She took the rocks out and was going to start a fire. She knocked them together. They sparked, but she couldn't get the little sticks that she had collected to light. So she got an idea. She got her bum roll and she tore it open and dug the cotton out and put that on the sticks and hit the rocks together again. They lit, the cotton lit, and caused the sticks to then catch, and she was able to start her nice little campfire. So old Claire, she's very handy like that. She knows about that survivalist stuff. She knows how to make what she has work for her. So she went to sleep there, and when she wakes up the next morning, they show her lying there and then she twitches a little bit like, you know, something might have, you know, tickled her or bit her. And then she flings the skirt that she was covering herself up with off and looks down at her legs and she is covered in fire ants. Oh my God. When I saw that, I guess it was CGI ants. It looked pretty real to me, but oh my God, it was like millions of them all over her legs. And she jumped up, and was brushing them off of her and, you know, trying to get them off. But the damage was already done. They had bitten her up. Her legs were just nothing but little bite marks all over. And those fire ants are no joke. They have like this venom and it just causes you to burn and itch. It is no joke. I remember one time being in a park when I was a kid, getting bitten on my foot by one fire ant, just one. And it drove me crazy for the rest of the day. It was a miserable feeling. The itching was unbearable. I can't imagine what it was like to have hundreds of bites, because she had to have hundreds on her legs. Oh, just the idea. Lord have mercy. But anyway, she called herself tearing some cloth from her garment and wrapping her legs. But I'm like, honey, that ain't going to do nothing. I know what them fire ants feel like. That's not going to do nothing except make you just, I don't know, maybe it would protect your legs a little bit when you're walking and your skirt won't brush against them. I guess that's what that was for, but whatever. But her legs were toe up. Anyway, you know, she continues to walk. She says in her narrator's voice that she wants to find some kind of road that would mean civilization. And perhaps there was a port, you know, she can maybe buy her way with Mrs. Johannes's coin. So convenient. She could buy her way to Jamaica, you know. So she's walking still, you know, and then the longer she walks, the weaker she gets because she hasn't had any water. Not really. After, you know, the sun starts to set again on her second day, she decides to make camp on this tree. or against this tree. So she falls asleep there on her second night. And when she wakes up the next morning, and as soon as I saw the close up of her face, I'm thinking, yeah, we got something on her. What's it going to be today? I already knew. And it turned out that it was a snake slithering across her chest. Now, me myself, if I had awakened and seen a large snake slithering across my chest, I would have screamed bloody murder until the snake bit me until I was dead, essentially. That's what would have happened with me. But Claire, cool as a cucumber, Claire just kind of woke up and laid there, immediately knew what was happening because she's Claire. And she laid very still. She let the snake crawl across her. And she just lay there, still as a board, as the snake slithered across her and then off and went on its merry way. Then she started to breathe again. I'm like, well, Claire is just a G. I mean, she is a G, man. You can't say nothing to Claire. Claire is prepared and Claire knows what to do in every situation. This is just awesome. So after that little experience, she gets up and starts to, you know, do some more traveling, some more walking. This is her third day now. So things are getting kind of desperate. She's weak. You can tell she's sunburned. She's chapped. She's starting to become disoriented. She's dizzy. Her vision is blurring. She comes to this point in the wood where I think she sees, or she does see, someone off in the distance. She sees this man in a robe. He's got his arms extended out, and I think he's either singing or praying. So she gets a little bit excited, but at this point she's weak and she stumbles forward a few steps, but then collapses. And, you know, thankfully his dog was running nearby and came across Claire and started sniffing around her. So that's how she got discovered. In the next scene, she wakes up and she's in a bed. She's in a house in a bed, and she looks down and sees that her legs are covered with like this green leafy substance. I guess it's like medicine to heal her bites. And she looks over next to her and sees on a side table a beautiful clear glass of water. And I know Claire is like, oh my God, I need that so bad. So she decides to try to reach for it, but then realizes that her hands, her wrists are tied to the bed. So are her ankles. And then this woman walks into the room. She's maybe a Hispanic woman or a Dominican woman, and she has a turban on her head, and she looks at Claire and says, don't even try to move. I have you tied up. It's for your own good. So Claire's like, please, water. So the woman reaches and gets the water off the side table and pours some into Claire's mouth. Claire's gasping and choking on it, but she's thankful to get it. She's trying to drink it quickly. Of course, it's too fast because she hasn't had water in a while, so she's spitting up as much as she's taking in. And then she asked the woman to untie her, but the woman says, no, you'll just scratch your legs up. Nope, not gonna do it. She says, I'm gonna take your clothes and wash them. So she goes over to the clothes that were on the, you know, chair next to the bed, and notices the zipper on the bodice, and she looks at it like, what the hell? And she gives Claire this little side eye like, what is this? But, you know, then she just kind of, you know, disregards it and takes the clothes out with her to launder. Soon Claire is nodding off again and passes out again. When she wakes up again, she sees this man staring down at her. And he's like, oh, you're awake. Oh, that's so wonderful. And he asks, and no, she asks him, where is she? And he says, oh, an English woman. Oh, that's wonderful. He says, well, I'm Father Frogden, I think was his name. And you're on, oh my God, what did he say the name of the island was? Saint something or another. And it was on some Saint-Domingue Island or something like that. So she's like, oh, that's just to the east. And she says, I need to get to Jamaica because my husband will be there. I need to meet him there. And he's like, well, if you go into the town, which is about a day's walk from here, surely you can get someone on a fishing boat to take you to Jamaica. And she's like, that's wonderful. So there's hope now. But I forgot what happens right after that. I think she wants to leave immediately, but no, she says something about he says that she's lucky that she hasn't run into any maroons. And she says, what are maroons? And he says, they're escaped slaves that hide out in the mountains. They can be unpredictable. Also, there are pirates around. Oh, yeah. And Lord knows. Oh, okay. And then there was this really funny part, too. Right when he was telling her about this, he speaks to this coconut that's on a shelf that he has named Coco. He takes the coconut down and talks to it and basically says, yes, Coco has reminded me of the maroons. You need to be very thankful that you haven't run into any of those maroons or any pirates. And Claire is looking at this fool like, oh shit, he's talking to a coconut. Okay. He's been out here for a minute in this place with just the woman who, by the way, he had told her was Mamacita. And Mamacita was the one that tied her to the bed because she didn't want Claire to scratch up her legs. But then he does untie Claire. But then, when he starts to talk to the coconut, yeah, Claire, at first thinking he was a nice, normal guy, when he starts talking to the coconut, she realizes maybe not so normal. Okay. But he seems harmless, so I think she's concerned, but not really scared. He just seems like he's just been out there for a long time and is affected by that. Kind of like Tom Hanks in Castaway when he was talking to Wilson, the soccer ball. Okay, this man is talking to the coconut just like Tom Hanks. It doesn't mean he's crazy. He's just been by himself for a minute. That's how people cope, whatever. So anyway, what happens? Oh yeah. When Mamacita comes back into the room, he says to Mamacita that Claire would need some fresh garments to wear. And he suggests perhaps a Melda. What is. Okay. There was this person that they kept speaking of, Mamacita and the Father Frogden, Imelda something or another. Mamacita, and he says perhaps Claire could wear, this lady could wear, Imelda, whatever her name is. We'll just call her Imelda for the sake of, since I can't remember her name. He says maybe she can wear that her dress, and the Mamacita looked offended and looked at Claire and then looked at him again and says, she can't wear that dress. She's a cow. Give her one of your robes. And then she leans over and sniffs Claire like, you stink. Time for you to take a bath. So in the next scene, Mamacita has drawn Claire a nice hot bath in one of those wooden tubs. And she leaves Claire a towel and some cake soap and lets her have it. And Claire takes off her old dirty shift and gets in that tub. She looks like she is so happy to get in that. So, Mamacita can be nasty all she wants. Thank you for the bath, ma'am. Claire was glad to get in that bath. So then later they have dinner. They're all at dinner. Claire is wearing the robe that belongs to Father Fogden. And Mamacita is serving them some stew or whatever. And they sit down to eat. And then he starts, Father Fogden starts. Well, no, I think Claire asks him how he came to be on this island. And he explains to her how he went to the land of Cuba 15 years prior to minister, you know, to the people there to do God's work. And that's until he met this woman, you know what I need to, let me find out what this woman's name is while I am sitting here just calling her whatever. Okay. The girl's name was, Ermendahilda. Ermendahilda was the woman's name. Anyway, he said until he met Ermendahilda, and Ermendahilda, wanted him. And he yearned for her. So they fell in love and decided that they wanted to be together. And Claire said that must have been pretty complicated since you're a priest. Okay, let me redo this part. All right, so all right, this is the part after he explains that he met Ermendahilda and fell in love. Okay. Claire said that it must have been complicated because he was a priest. And he says, oh, yes, it was. Which is why we decided to run away. So they decided to run, leaving her husband, Don Armando, who he described as a cruel wealthy man with influence behind. And it just so happens that the English invaded Cuba the same day that they decided to leave. So with all the chaos going on, they managed to escape. He also said that his loyalty to the crown also helped him obtain, you know, I guess, privilege. We all know about that privilege, right? So he was able to get away with Ermendahilda. Unfortunately, she fell ill. Oh, Ermendahilda and her mother, Mamacita. But unfortunately, Ermendahilda fell ill and she died. So he said, God rest her soul. He crossed himself and so did Mamacita, who, you know, seems still very haunted by the whole notion of her daughter being dead. And Claire said, I'm so sorry to hear that. Oh God, what happens after that? So, you know, after that somber moment, he, jumps up and, gets this little, box off the shelf. And he says to Claire, may I offer you some yupa? And he sits down and opens up the little box and takes out a pipe and a little baggie. And he says it can make you feel quite euphoric. It doesn't take a genius to recognize what's happening here. And Clara goes, nah, I'm good. Thanks. So he takes his pipe and loads it up with the yupa. Lights it and begins to puff. Puff, 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 puff. Now we know why this motherfucker is crazy as he is. He basically probably smokes a lot of yupa / weed. And, you know, if you do that enough, it can have an effect on you over time. So, yeah, that might be one of the reasons why his best friend now is a coconut. Anyway. So, you know, Claire watches him for half a second. Then she says, okay, look, remember that town you mentioned earlier? The one where I could catch a fishing boat to Jamaica. I would like to leave for that in the morning. And he laughs and he goes, oh, no, you can't. You're not well enough yet. He says, Coco and I would never forgive ourselves if we allowed you to do that. And I'll be escorting you, but it won't be for another week. And Claire was like, a week? And he's like, yeah, you're not well enough to leave yet. She's like, I'm a doctor. I think I know how well I am and how fit I am to travel. He says, nah, you're not well enough yet. And you're being so agitated right now. It's just an example of your fatigue. You know, that's a symptom of your fatigue. And, you know, maybe we'll just wait 2 weeks and then I'll see you over to that town then. And Mamacita's looking at him like, what the hell? And Clara's like, look, I need to get to Jamaica now and I can't wait that long. I need to get to my husband. And he's still trying to argue. And Mamacita said that, oh, hold on now. What the hell? You trying to replace this bitch with my daughter? Is that what you trying to place my daughter with this bitch? You know, she would never replace my daughter. He says, Mamacita, she's our guest. Fuck that. She a whore. Claire just keeps they just keep calling Claire a whore. Nobody likes Claire. You know, I don't know what that is. And mostly the women, though. The men like her just fine. So Mamacita and the father start to argue. Claire's like, okay, this ain't none of my business. She gets up, moves to another room, finds her a little mirror, like a little hand mirror, and puts it in her pocket. We know that that will become handy at some point later. And Mamacita says, I'm in charge now. And I say she needs to go. Shut up. And then leaves. So when he comes over and sees that Claire is kind of sitting over in this other area, and there's a dress in the background, by the way, a really elaborate dress. He comes over and he says, oh, I see that you were admiring this extraordinary garment. And he goes over to the dress and kind of looks at it, and he says, this was a Menehilda's dress. And he says, you know, Amenahilda was Mamacita's only child, and she's still grieving over the loss of her daughter. And Claire kind of looks sympathetic, probably thinking about Brianna. And she says, I understand. And he says, she thinks that I want to replace you, her with you. She thinks that I'll forget Amenahilda. What she doesn't understand is that I could never forget her. And she says, once you love someone as much as I loved Amenahilda, it never leaves you. And he asks Claire, have you ever loved someone like that? She says, yes, my husband. And he says, okay, well then we need to help you get to him. Then he pulls the okie doke on her and says, I will consult with Coco in the morning and he will know whether or not it's a good idea to leave that soon. And he walks over to the table again, and Claire is left standing there like, what in the fuck? All right, so the next day, Claire wakes up. You know, this is the morning that she wants to leave. So she gets up and notices that her clothes are folded neatly, lying next to the bed. She knows that Mamacita is the one that left them there. And realizes that Mamacita is ready for her ass to go and is willing to do whatever she can to help in this. And Claire, of course, is like fine with that. But she has to convince Father Fogden. And you can see that she comes up with an idea. In the next scene, we show that Father Fogden is coming into the area where Claire is, and Claire is dressed and talking. Yes, I'm feeling much better now. Thank you ever so. Oh, really? Thank you so much. And when he comes into the area where Claire is holding the coconut cocoa, talking to it, going, well, thank you very much, Coco. I appreciate that. Thank you, girl. And and then she looks over at Father Fogden. Oh, hi, Father Fogden. Nice to see you. I was just talking to Coco here, and she was just telling me that today is a good day to go to the village. Isn't that great? Even Father Fogden was looking at her like, what the bitch, if you know. But before he can react, really, Mamacita is screaming somewhere in the distance, Father Fogden, Father Fogden. And she's screaming, whatever. And he runs out and sees that she's running toward him with this severed head of a skinned like the skinned severed head of a goat. You know, he's got all these goats that he keeps there at this village, not village, but at this house or whatever where he's been living. He's got lots of goats, and this is one of them, apparently has been skinned and slaughtered. She says they skinned him, they slaughtered him, and they ate him, roasted him on a spit, or her rather. These are female goats. So roasted her on a spit. So she handed the severed head to him, and he goes, "Oh, Arabella, poor Arabella." I'm like, okay, this was a pet. So he takes the head and sits it down, and then goes to get this jar of something, and he brings it back, and he says a little something about God failing to take care of her or Arabella. And he pours these bugs out of this jar onto the severed head. And they look like large beetles of some kind. And there's a lot of them. And they just start crawling all over the head, you know. And I guess they're eating away the flesh, which is, I guess, the purpose of it, since I guess he plans to keep the skull. And as he's watching and Claire is looking like she's about to be sick to her stomach, he says they're voracious little fellows, can be found in a cave, a sacred cave called a Bandaway. Now, this strikes a memory with Claire. She thinks back to Mary McNabb, the crazy person from when she was back in Edinburgh with Jamie, when she first met him at the print shop. And this woman who was like catatonic, and her brother was taking advantage of her, you know, because she had these fits or these ravings. And one of the times that she raved when Claire was there, she said something about a Bandaway will devour you. The Bandaway, a Bandaway. And Claire remembered that. And she asked Father Fogden what a Bandaway was. And Father Fogden explained that it was a hallowed cave to the natives of Jamaica. And that it was a place of great power, and that people were known to disappear there. So, you know, then he's just staring, you know, at the skull as the beetles eat at the flesh. And he says, how could they do this? How could these sailors do that to Arabella? He says, just kill her and roast her on a spit like that. A feast for a Chinaman. And as soon as he says Chinaman, Claire starts and looks at him and goes, what? Chinaman? What was that? So Claire was like, where were these sailors? Where was this Chinaman? And Father Fogden asks Mamacita, she says they were on the beach, a bunch of sailors and the Chinaman, and there was a bunch of broken sails, and they were scattered all over the beach. And Claire was like, where can I find them? And Father Fogden was like, what does it matter? They ate my goat, man. And she's like, I don't care, man. I want to, you know. Well, she didn't say I don't care. She says, I'm sorry for it, but I need to find these sailors. Oh, where was their boat? Where are they? And Mamacita just took over then. She says, oh, they're straight this way. Go through here. Go straight through these woods. And run, girl, run. You can find them if you run fast. Mamacita was ready for her to go. And she went. She left. So Claire went running through the woods. And it seemed like she was running forever. So then they switched to the beach. And of course, yes, it is who she thought. It was Mr. Willoughby. And it was the crew of the Artemis. And they basically kind of shipwrecked on the beach. They ran into some rough water, and their boat, the sail, the mast broke, and they ended up on the beach, and they lost several people. As Jamie and Fergus were there discussing it, they revealed that, the captain, Captain Rains, Mr. Warren, and Mr. Murphy all died, in the, wreckage. or in the you know, ship being whatever wrecked on the beach. They ended up at the bottom of the sea. Isn't that just convenient? They were like the biggest assholes on the ship, right? So, yeah, good. Now we can, you know, do what we need to do, that these bad men are gone. We can now run this shit and take over. So after Jamie and Fergus pretty much establish for the audience what happened and why they're stranded on the beach, we see that Leslie and Hayes and all of the people of Jamie's crew are pretty much still there. They're trying to fix the main, the mast. Jamie goes over to Masale so that she can sew the rip in the mainsail. And they're basically just getting everything together so they can make it to Kingston and Jamie can be reunited with Claire, where he thinks is still on a porpoise and is going to be dropped off there for him to pick up. He has no idea about the warrants. He has no idea about any of the stuff that has gone wrong, of course. Claire, she's still running through the jungle trying to make it to the beach while they're, you know, getting things together. They're getting the masts onto the boat. They're getting the sail fixed and put onto the boat. Claire's running. We basically get this montage all of a sudden of Claire running through the beach or through the woods or through the jungle trying to make it to the beach in time. And she almost misses them because they manage to get everything onto the Artemis again, set up the sail, and they get ready to take off. And Claire makes it after they've already left the beach. She gets there and she sees the Artemis out in the ocean. They haven't taken off just yet, but they're getting ready to. And they're kind of far away from the shore. So Claire is yelling, "Jamie, Jamie," but he can't hear her. So she remembers the little mirror. Remember the mirror that she swipes from Father Fogden? Well, she takes it out at this point and decides to use it to reflect the sunlight so that it can, you know, reflect and be a signal for Jamie to see. And of course, he sees it. He looks over there. He sees the little reflection. He's like, "What is that?" Then he asks for one of the crewmen to give him his looking glass. So he looks through it and looks toward the beach and sees that it's Claire. He's like, "Sassenach." And, you know, they get a boat, go back to the beach. And then Jamie does this Harlequin romance, dirty, billowy shirt run towards Claire. "Claire, Sassenach." And Jamie's running. Claire is running toward him. "Jamie, Claire, Jamie, Claire." And then they jump into each other's arms and he spins her around and they kiss passionately and they're back together again. Oh, don't you just love a happy ending? Oh, yeah. And I forgot to mention that while Claire was running through the jungle, she snagged her arm on this like pointy branch, this broken branch that was sticking out jagged, and ripped a pretty good sized tear in her arm. So she's running through the jungle, holding on to her bloody arm, but she's not going to let that stop her. So anyway, as Jamie and Claire are finishing up their reuniting embrace and kissing and hugging, Jamie looks down and notices the tear in her arm, the blood on her arm, and is like, "What happened?" You know, and then in the next scene, Leonard and Hayes, who I guess are now supposed to be the new Angus and Rupert, which they could never be, I'm sorry, but they're funny enough, you know. Anyway, they're sitting, you know, as Claire, Jamie, and Mr. Willoughby. I think Mr. Willoughby is mending Claire's arm. So Hayes and Lindsay are kind of sitting near the boat, what is the little boat, the rowboat that they use to go back to the shore? They're standing by, and Lindsay says to Hayes, "You know, Mrs. Fraser, McDew's wife, she ends up in the most unlikeliest of places. She's a very unusual woman." Yeah. And then Hayes is like, "Yeah, she just drops out of nowhere all the time. It's just weird, you know." I thought that was funny because, yes, all of this stuff is very convenient and very funny that they happen to find each other in this very unlikely but still important part of the story, because they had to get back together. You know, they couldn't be lost from each other forever, even if it is unlikely, even if it is just this weird scenario that is not likely to have ever happened in reality. This is a story, and it, in order for it to be a good story, it has to be, you know, convenient. It's the things like this have to happen. Otherwise, it would be just a tragic real life scenario that usually ends up with two people never finding each other again and one of them dying. That's not a good story. You can't have that happen. So yes, these convenient coincidences have to happen in order for the story to push along and be a good story. So Mr. Willoughby is stitching Clara's arm up and, you know, doing a decent job of it as Claire and Jamie discuss everything that has happened thus far. Jamie talks about Claire jumping into the ocean and how crazy that was, but he's grateful to Father Fogden for finding her, even if he was kind of weird. And Claire was like, well, I jumped into the ocean because I had to warn you about the warrants. And then Jamie was like, so they found the body in the cask of Creme de Menthe. And Mr. Willoughby is like, we should have cut that body up so they wouldn't have anything to find. You know, so anyway, they just kind of recap everything for us, for the audience. You know, it's very nice and wrapped up in a nice little bow. So anyway, when Mr. Ability finishes Claire's stitches, Jamie tells Claire that he gave Fergus and Marcellie permission to marry and gave his blessing. So Jamie, you know, is helping Claire wrap her arm and pour some alcohol on it to try and disinfect it. And then he says, with so much death and destruction, it would be nice to have a little bit of joy in all of this. And Claire was like, well, what did you have in mind? And Jamie said, a wedding. And Claire was like, well, I think I know someone who can help us with that. So in the next scene, Mr. Willoughby is holding a crate of chickens in front of Father Fogden, who is standing there very stoically with his weed pipe in his mouth. And Mr. Willoughby is apologizing essentially for killing Arabella, explaining that he did not realize that Arabella was beloved and that where he is from, goats are not revered as they are here and as they should be. So he offered Father Fogden the little crate of two chickens in apology for his killing of Arabella. Father Fogden accepted the chickens and then said to Mr. Willoughby, I forgive you. You know, once I was a stranger in a strange land as well, so I know what you're going through. And he offered Mr. Willoughby his pipe and said, would you like some yuma? And Mr. Willoughby nodded, yes, and took it and proceeded to puff. So later, Marcellie is getting dressed, getting ready for her wedding ceremony. And Claire comes in and asks her if she needs some help. And she helps her with her dress, tying her bodice. And then she asks Marcellie, are you nervous? And Marcellie's like, no, why would I be nervous? And Claire was like, because it's normal. You know, I was nervous on my wedding day. And she says, because there was so much that I didn't know. And Marcellie has this look on her face like, well, okay, there is something. So she says, okay, there's something that I do not ken. She says, when Fergus and I lie together, how do I keep from having a bairn? And Clara's like, don't you want a child? And Marcellie's like, yes, someday. But right now, I just want to enjoy Fergus without all that complication. And Marcellie says, you know, Fergus says he knows what to do, but... And he says, you know, we just have to get past that first time and then I'll enjoy it. But I'm not sure that's true. And Claire says, why wouldn't it be? And Marcy says, well, when Jamie and my ma first married, whenever he would pull her close, she would shrink away. And when I saw you with Jamie on the ship, I saw that when he was with you, you seemed to enjoy being with him. You enjoyed each other. And she says, I want to be happy with Fergus like you are with Daddy, without have to worry about a bairn. So Claire promises Marcelly that when they get back to the ship, she'll show her how to do that, how to enjoy sex without worrying about pregnancy. And Marcelly says, oh, so there is a way. Okay, great. Perhaps you're not a devil after all. So they have a nice little moment there. So in the next scene, we are at the ceremony of Fergus and Marcelly. Everyone is gathered. Fergus and Marcelly are standing before Father Fogden. And he starts out with saying he bestows his blessings on everyone. And then he looks over to the wrong guy and says, do you take this woman? And the man says, nope, nope, not me. It's him, Fergus. And he looks at Fergus and he goes, what? This guy? He doesn't have a hand with the bride mind. And Marcelly is like, I would not. And then Father Fogden says, well, I don't suppose it's an impediment unless he's missing a cock. And he looks at Marcelly and goes, he hasn't, has he? And she goes, well, if you would hurry up, we could find out, or I could find out. I like Marcelly. I really do. And Fergus says, Marcelly. And she's like, you know, I've been waiting to bed you for months. And Fergus apologizes to the father and says, I'm sorry, Father Faulkner, she speaks her mind. That's one of the many things I love about her. So then Father Fogden asks her to give her full name. And she says, Marcelly Jane McKimmy, I believe. So then Father Fogden goes into this little tangent about her name, Marcelly. Ah, what a lovely name, Marcelly. Marcelly, so lovely. And Marcelly's like, look, you going to keep on havering it about my name or you going to marry us? Get on with it. It's like, okay, at this point, or even maybe a little before this, we are aware that Father Fogden is either high or drunk, one or the other, maybe both. So then he goes on to say, do you, Marcelly Jane McKimmy, take this man to have and to hold, to love and to cherish, to forsaking all others? And Marcelly's like, yeah, okay, yes, I do. So then he looks at Fergus and he says, and you have a name? And he says, and a cock? Because I can't marry you if you don't have one. It's not allowed. I love this scene. And Fergus says, yes, Fergus. And Father Fogden says, the whole name in its entirety, please. And Fergus says, just Fergus. And Father Fogden says, you have a surname, don't you? And Fergus says, no, just Fergus. And Father Fogden says, I cannot marry you properly without a surname. So they just kind of stand there looking at each other. Fergus is looking at Marcelly. Then he's shaking his head like, no. And then Jamie speaks up. Fraser. Fergus Claudel Fraser. And man. Oh, see, even right now, I am reacting because that was such a nice moment. Mm-mm-mm. I love that. That is a moment in the book that everybody freaks out about and gets emotional over. And even now, as I'm sitting here reflecting on it, it is an emotional moment. because, of course, Fergus is Jamie's son in every way that it matters. Jamie found Fergus in that brothel when Fergus was just a little boy. He's raised him from that into this man that he has become. And he is the closest thing that Fergus has ever had to a father. So, of course, he should have Jamie's last name. And when Fergus saw that, the look on his face, the happiness, and the just sheer bliss. Oh, God. Oh, I'm fanning myself right now. Because that was just such a precious, beautiful moment in the book as well as in the show. They did it beautifully. I loved it. I loved it. So then Fergus looks at Father Fogden and says, "My name is Fergus Claudel Fraser." And Father Fogden says, "Okay, great, wonderful. So do you, Fergus Claudel Fraser, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife?" And he's, "Yes." He says, "Yes." And he looks over to the man on his left and asks for the ring. He gets that from him, puts that on Rosalie's hand. And Father Fogden wraps it up saying, "I now pronounce you husband and wife. You may now kiss the bride." And they kiss, and that's it. They're married. Oh, it was a beautiful, beautiful moment. I loved it. I loved everything about it. So back on the Artemis, they're sailing now, headed to Jamaica. And Claire is in the captain's quarters, which is now Jamie's quarters, by the way. How convenient. So she's eating some turtle soup, some soup, and she seems a little off. You notice it as she's trying to pour some more soup into her bowl. She seems a little bit wonky. But then Jamie comes in. He says, "You left this," and he's carrying her pouch. He says, "You left this, didn't take it on a porpoise with you." And Clara's like, "Yeah, it's my antibiotic. It wasn't enough to treat all the men. Besides, that antibiotic wouldn't work on typhoid." And she says, "You know, this soup is delicious." And Jamie's like, "Yeah, Mr. Willoughby made it special for you." And he goes over to her and kisses her. And then he touches her face. He says, "Whoa, you're burning up." She says, "I know. That's why I asked you to bring this to me." And she opens up her pouch and pulls out the antibiotic. And she says, "I need to give myself a shot of this." She's trying to maneuver the needle into the bottle or into the syringe. Well, she actually manages to do that really well one-handed. And Jamie says, "Do you need any help with that?" She says, "No, I got it." And she's trying to take the syringe and stick it into the bottle of antibiotic, but she can't do it. He says, "Look, let me help with that. Let me help you with that." So he gets the antibiotic into the syringe into the antibiotic bottle, and pulls some into the syringe. And Claire asks him to. She lifts up a gown and asks him to give her the shot. And she says, "This is your chance to get revenge after I did the same thing to you." So she lifts her dress up and exposes her left or her buttock. And he says, "You want me to stab you in the ass?" And she's like, "Yes, yes, do it." And so Jamie has a syringe like he's getting ready to do it. And he's hesitant and he's looking at her butt and looking at the syringe. And he gets ready to do it, but he's hesitating. And then he goes, "Oh, I can't do it. I can't do it." So Cher's like, "Give me that." Not Cher. Did I say Cher? Claire's like, let me do that. Let me get it." So Claire takes the syringe from Jamie and decides to give herself the injection. She pushes the plunger into her thigh, tells Jamie to push it down and inject her with the antibiotic. And she goes, "Yeah, there. So that wasn't so bad. Okay. Yeah, I think I did that part. Okay." So then Clara gets all frisky. She's smiling at Jamie and giving him that eye. And he's like, "What's wrong with you?" And she's like, "Bolt the door." He's like, "No, I would not take advantage of a woman who is injured and feverish and also drunk." She says, "Drunk? What are you talking about? You can't drunk off turtle soup. He's like, you can off of Willoughby's because he put a whole bottle of sherry in it, a sherry in it from the smell of it. And she's like, well, don't worry about it. Come here. I want you. And he's like, no. He's like, you'll hurt your arm. She says, let me worry about my arm. So, you know, she's all over him and they start fooling around. And she puts the bolt on her door and then they start ripping each other's clothes off. He takes his clothes off. She takes off hers and they end up butt naked and he takes it from the back and starts doing it. And then Mr. Willoughby, of course, at that moment comes to the door and says, honorable wife, how did you enjoy the turtle soup? And Jamie answers for her. Oh, she enjoyed it very much. Thank you, Mr. Willoughby. And he goes, yes, that was a really good Hawksville turtle or something like that. He says, yes, a very majestic beast. I made another pot if you'd like some more. And Miss Jamie says, no, she's had enough. And Claire says, no, I haven't. Meanwhile, while this conversation is going on, Mr. Willoughby is outside the door yelling through the door. And Claire and Jamie are inside the room. Bumping around and having a good old rip-roaring time as they are screwing like rabbits. And Mr. Willoughby says, so would she like some more? And then Claire, and now Mr. Jamie says, no. Then he says, good night, Mr. Willoughby. And he says good night to them. But he can hear that they're bumping around and they're moaning, groaning, and obviously fucking. And he smiles and walks away. And that is the end of the episode. And I loved it. It was so fun, so funny. Most of the episode was serious, of course, with Claire being stranded on the beach and in the jungles of San Dominic or whatever the fuck, where the fuck she was. And with the crazy priest and Mamacita. But when they get back together, that was just great. I love the reunion. I love the wedding. Oh my God, the wedding was so great. And the whole Jamie giving Fergus his name thing. Oh, that was all so wonderful. This was a great episode, guys. This was one of the better episodes of Outlander. I enjoyed it very much. And I've got to put this in the top five of my favorite all-time Outlander episodes. This was great. I enjoyed it very much. All right, guys, that's it for me this week. I'm going to go ahead and just leave it at that. I'm not going to do any book comparisons. You guys know what it is, so it's not necessary. At least those of you who are book readers. The ones who have not, most of the time, y'all don't like the book comparisons anyway, so we'll just leave it at that. All right, I'm out. I will see you guys next week. Next week. We're going to be on the next to last episode of the season. And that's going to be episode 12 entitled The Bakra. So we will see you guys then. In the meantime, have a great week and don't do anything I wouldn't do. All right. Take care. Oh, yeah. And for those of you who didn't know, I am an Alabama native or an Alabama person, and yesterday was the Iron Bowl. I am an Auburn fan. We killed it. We stomped them Bammers. War Eagle, goddammit. War motherfucking Eagle. That's what I'm talking about. See you guys next week. Bye.